Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Hello, and welcome to the March edition of Third Thursdays with Ruthie. I'm Ruthie Goodbow from Ogletree Deacons, and I want to welcome everybody to this month's podcast. So March comes in like a lion, out like a lamb, or in like a lamb, out like a lion. But we're talking about animals and figures and symbols. So what does that have to do with labor law? Well, in labor, or at least in organizing, there are some symbols that we're all probably very familiar with. I'm sure you've all seen the inflatable fat cat, maybe the greedy pig, and even the union bug. But probably the most recognizable of all union symbols is Scabby the rat. I think everybody's probably seen Scabby with his red beady eyes and his big fangs. But his name, as you probably guessed, comes from the term scab, which was used to shame workers who tried to break strikes or cross picket lines. He's been around for about 40 years. He first showed his face about 1976. Interestingly, a little company in Illinois is credited with designing Scabby. And interesting, I guess from my perspective, is even though Scabby is used to try and shame employers and shame employees who cross picket lines, Scabby is not made by a unionized workforce. Scabby does have his own Twitter account, and I guess he costs somewhere between $2,500 and $10,000, depending on what size rat you want. For a very long time, about 30 years since he first started to show his face, Scabby has been protected as a First Amendment expression of interest. But that protection may soon change. It may become more limited. Here to talk to me about Scabby's role in union protests is my colleague and good friend, Brian Hayes. Good morning, Brian, and welcome.
Thanks, Ruthie, and good morning to you. It's good to be with you.
Brian is a shareholder in our Washington, D.C. office. We serve as the co-chair of Ogletree's traditional labor practice. But you may know Brian better as the great dissenter from his time as a member on the National Labor Relations Board. So, Brian, let's start off with a little background. From a legal perspective, what's the difference between picketing, handbilling, bannering, and where does Scabby fit into all those categories? And why is his presence, so to speak, protected?
Well, you know, it's difficult to imagine that a simple balloon can create very complex legal questions. But my favorite member of the rodent family has certainly managed to do just that. Now, the question you just posed lies at the center of those legal issues, and I'll talk about them in just a minute. But first, it's important to understand the factual and the legal context in which Scabby typically makes his appearance. A union typically deploys Scabby at the site of an employer or company that has chosen a non-union contractor to perform work on its property. The union doesn't like the fact that the contractor is non-union, so it is effectively trying to put pressure on the employer who hired the non-union contractor to cease doing business with the offending contractor. This is a classic example of what's referred to in labor law as secondary pressure. In other words, the union is pressuring the hiring employer here by displaying a rat, even though its real or primary dispute is not with the hiring employer, but with the subcontractor.
So you use the term secondary pressure, and maybe it would be helpful if you gave us a couple other examples or another example of what you're talking about in terms of that secondary pressure.
Sure. For example, let's say Joe's Market is doing renovations, and Joe turns around and hires Mike's Woodworking, a non-union contractor, to do the carpentry work associated with the renovations. The next day, the Carpenters Union shows up with Scabby, and with signs saying, Joe is a slime ball, uses non-union substandard labor, or something to that effect. Of course, the whole idea is to have Joe fire Mike and hire a contractor whose employees are members of the Carpenters Union to do the carpentry work. Now, Section 8B4 of the National Labor Relations Act makes certain forms of this kind of quote-unquote secondary pressure unlawful. Section 8B4 reads kind of like the Internal Revenue Code, and it's the most complicated part of the National Labor Relations Act. And I'm not going to try this morning to unpack the whole thing here. But the bottom line is this. In the example I just laid out, if the use of scabby is found to be analogous to hand billing, for example, the passing out of written fact sheets about Joe's use of non-union labor to potential shoppers, then it's lawful. If, however, the use of scabby is found to be analogous to picketing, then it's not lawful. So we come back to the very nub of your original question, Ruthie, and the central legal issue. What is it that constitutes picketing? This was a fundamental question in a series of cases that were pending before the board when I became a member of the board in 2010. Now, those cases didn't involve scabby, although their holding was subsequently applied to all of the cases involving scabby. Rather, this series of cases involved a similar union tactic called bannering. Bannering, as the name kind of implies, involves a union's use of a typically very large and eye-catching banner that's displayed in front of the secondary employer's place of business. Again, in our example, rather than deploying scabby to protest Mike's non-union status, the union would unfurl a huge banner on the public sidewalk in front of Joe's market saying, "Joe is a slimeball, uses non-union substandard labor." Now, in those cases, the first of which, or the lead case of which, is one called Eliason and Knuth, in those cases, a majority of the then board found that bannering was not analogous to picketing, and it was therefore lawful. Now, in support of that view, the majority noted that the banner was stationary. Thus, there was no patrolling or walking back and forth that is typically associated with picketing. Moreover, they relied on the fact that the union agents didn't confront physically any would-be patrons, nor did they threaten anyone or block access to Joe's market.
So, Brian, you say that a majority of the NLRB found that bannering was not the same as picketing. But I think anybody who would know you, or maybe who has read some of the cases that were decided while you were a member of the board, or even can hear perhaps in the tone of your voice, may have a different view. So what's your position in terms of the scabby as bannering, as picketing?
Yeah, well, you know, in those bannering cases, I disagreed with the view that the majority had. And as it was often the case during my term on the board, wound up filing a dissenting opinion in which I found that it was more analogous to picketing. I believed then, and I continue to believe, that the distinctions that the majority relied on in those bannering cases, for example, the fact that union agents are moving or not moving, are largely immaterial to the correct analysis. I think the real question is whether the union's actions are designed to intimidate people by their conduct or to persuade people by virtue of their communication. Whether it's banners or balloons or handbills or flyers, the goal is always the same. The point of doing all that is to dissuade customers from patronizing Joe's or another secondary employer so that Joe, in this case, will stop using Mike, the non-union contractor. However, in the case of handbilling or passing out flyers, the union is attempting to do that by communicating facts and arguments, which may or may not be valid, but are nonetheless protected, to the public. And they're doing so in a non-confrontational way. They are, for want of a better way of putting it, appealing to a customer's intellect. Banners and balloons, or big rat balloons, however, are designed to be intimidating and to be confrontational, just like picketing is. They don't appeal to customers' intellect. They appeal to their apprehensions. So for me anyway, that's the proper mode of analysis for distinguishing between permissible handbilling or analogous activity and impermissible picketing.
You know, it's interesting you said that about intimidation. I was with my niece a weekend ago. She spends a lot of time in New York City, and she says, every week I turn the corner and there's a big rat somewhere, and it always frightens me. So I think you're on point there. But I've heard, and I think others may have also, that Peter Robb, the general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, he isn't a big fan of scabby. And we've heard that he may be trying to limit what type of activity can occur when the rat is around. I wonder if you can give us some insight into GC Robb's perspective.
Yeah, sure. I should begin by saying that those cases that I talked about, the bannering cases and the subsequently decided Scabby the Rat cases, all of which found that to be by a board majority protected, remain the law today. Those have not been overruled. I'm not sure that that's going to be the case for long, you see, because in the secondary employer context that we've been talking about, I believe that Peter Robb, the GC, shares the same view as I do about making distinctions between what is permissible leafleting and what is impermissible picketing. I think his own analysis is the same. The reason I say that is in a case out in Illinois involving the Operating Engineers Union, Peter Robb, the current general counsel of the NLRB, is currently seeking a federal court injunction to prevent the union from deploying the rat balloon at the sites of several secondary employers that use a company called Donegal Services, a non-union contractor. The union has used Scabby at the sites of a number of these employers, along with banners reading, quote, shame on, and then naming the secondary employer, for harboring a rat contractor, unquote. Now, in seeking the injunction, the GC, in the papers the GC filed, they filed a brief in support of their requested injunction, in which the general counsel makes largely the same arguments that I made in the bannering case or case dissents, and he even directly cites those dissents. So I think in terms of the legality of Scabby's use or a bannering in general, I think the general counsel is largely on the same page as I am and as I expressed in those dissents in Elias and in Newth.
So for those of us out here who like to read these cases, if we need something either to put us to sleep or wake us up, who like to read board cases, what cases in particular does the GC think should be overruled?
Yeah, well, I think, as I said, that clearly to turn the ship around and to turn Scabby into impermissible secondary activity, that issue would require overruling the case that I mentioned earlier, Eliason and Newth. Eliason and Newth Construction. It's the 2010 case that's the lead case involving bannering. There were other bannering cases subsequent, you know, that were decided after Eliason and Newth, but all of them relied on exactly the same analysis that the majority lays out in Eliason and which I contested in the dissent. So that from a board perspective anyway, the case that's got to be overturned would be Eliason and all the other associated cases. The other problematic case for Peter Robb, the general counsel, is not a board case, but it is a board case, but the real problem lies with the subsequent federal court decision. Mm-hmm. It's a problem for Robb, and I think it's a problem as well, too. It's a case called Brandon Regional Medical Center that was decided by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. In that case, instead of Scabby, the union staged a kind of mock funeral, complete with casket and somebody dressed up as the Grim Reaper. They held this mock funeral in front of a hospital that employed a non-union contractor. They also displayed the rat, too. But the court found that the mock funeral was not the equivalent of picketing and that, therefore, the mock funeral enjoyed First Amendment protections. That's a problem. That D.C. Circuit case is a problem to the analysis that I think the general counsel would employ and that I agree with.
You know, that's interesting because you talked about the difference between appealing to the customer or client's intellect as opposed to fear. And you talked about that in your dissent. And I can't think of anything that would be appealing to somebody's apprehension than a mock funeral in front of a hospital. So it makes me wonder, so what, if anything, can G.C. Robb do, or what is he doing to support his belief and his approach?
First of all, remember the way the board works. Peter Robb may have a view of this, but he's got to get a case up, first of all, before the board. So in order for the board to reverse cases like Eliason and at the same time to formulate an answer to the D.C. Circuit's view in Brandon, the board needs to have a case in front of it that raises those issues. Now, the Illinois case that I mentioned earlier is not presently at the board. It's in the federal court on an injunction action. Now, it may or may not eventually wind up at the board. Short of that, Robb needs to instruct the regional office, various regional offices of the NLRB, which he probably already has, to be on the lookout for cases involving the Eliason approach and Scabby the Rat, and to forward such cases to Washington to the board's Division of Advice. Once that's done, he can direct the issuance of a complaint and get the question before the board. Now, since Scabby is so frequently deployed at neutral employer sites, finding a case to be the vehicle for overturning Eliason and discussing and distinguishing the thinking of the D.C. Circuit in Brandon shouldn't be difficult.
So before we wrap up, I'd like to quickly mention an interesting decision that just came out of the Seventh Circuit. A little bit different take on this. The circuit court upheld a zoning ordinance in a small town in Wisconsin, and that ordinance banned all private signs on public right-of-ways, including banning good old Scabby during the union protests. So I'm curious, why didn't the ordinance violate the union's First Amendment rights?
The case in the Seventh Circuit, first of all, found no need to analyze the picketing issue that we've been discussing. It centered on the constitutional First Amendment issue, but it's nonetheless instructive to the claims that, you know, Scabby enjoys First Amendment protections, because what the Seventh Circuit did is it found that the government is entitled to restrict even protected speech in a public forum without running afoul of the First Amendment, provided that the restriction is A, content neutral, that is, it's uniformly enforced regardless of the message or the circumstance, B, that it's narrowly tailored to serve a significant governmental interest, and C, that it leaves open other alternative means to communicate the message. The circuit held that the signs that the no signs ordinance in question met all three prongs of this test. So that's important, I think, in applying that logic to the second argument that one typically gets in the case of Scabby. The first hurdle is whether or not it's protected under the Act. The second is whether it's protected under the First Amendment. And I think the Seventh Circuit decision clearly indicates that there are limits on those First Amendment protections, and that Scabby, under the proper set of circumstances, can be found to be its use violative without any First Amendment implications.
So we all know that changes that come out of the NLRB, sometimes they happen very quickly and we're surprised by them, but more often things move quite slowly. So with that in mind, right now, given the current status of the law, if Scabby shows up at my business, do I have some rights or recourse? What should I do?
Yeah, you sure do. I mean, if you are the secondary employer or the neutral employer, or going back to the example, if you're Joe's Market, then you can immediately file an 8B4 charge with the NLRB's regional office, and you couple that charge with a request for injunctive relief. That's the kind of vehicle that actually Peter Robb is very likely looking for. That's clearly what happened in this Donegal Services case, too. So it's an 8B4 charge against the offending union and coupled with a request for injunctive relief. An employer could also consider filing a federal lawsuit if, for example, they are monetarily damaged by virtue of the bannering or the display of Scabby or whatever it is. Section 303 of the National Labor Relations Act provides for a private right of action by an employer against a union for monetary, for any monetary harm it suffers by virtue of a union's violation of Section 8B4. So there are some tools in the tools in the toolbox for secondary employers to deal with scabby and bannering and other forms of secondary pressure.
Well, I think that's all the time we have to talk about scabby today. Thanks, Brian, for joining us. Really appreciate it. And we'll keep an eye on that rat and the rulings coming out of the NLRB and see what's in store for scabby's future. Until then, please don't be shy about sending me your feedback about the series and any ideas you may have for future topics. You can reach me at ruthie.goodbow@ogletreedeacons.com. Now, be bold and mighty forces will come to your aid.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.